The next time I saw Robert Putney Drake was a turning point. I was being sent to New York again, on a mission for naval intelligence this time, and Winifred gave me a message that had to be delivered to Drake personally. The Order wouldn't trust any mechanical communication device. Strangely, my CIA drop also gave me a message for Drake, and it was the same message. That didn't jar me any, since it merely confirmed some of what I had begun to suspect by then. I went to this office on Wall Street, near the corner of Broad, just about where I'd be toiling at corporate law if my family had its way. And I told his secretary, "Carnegie of Pyramid Productions, to see Mr. Drake." That was the password that week. Carnegie had been a Bavarian baron and second-in-command to Weishaupt in the original AISB. I sat and cooled my heels a while, studying the decor, which was heavily Elizabethan, and made me wonder if Drake had some private notion about being a reincarnation of his famous ancestor. Finally, Drake's door opened, and who stood there but Atlanta Hope, looking kind of wild-eyed and distraught. Drake had his arm on her shoulder, and he said piously,
"May your work hasten the day when America returns to purity."
She stumbled past me in a kind of daze, and I was ushered into his office. He motioned me to an overstuffed chair and stared at my face until something clicked.
"Another Carnegie in the woodpile,"
he laughed suddenly.
"Ha ha ha! The last time I saw you, you were a Pinkerton detective."
You had to admire a memory like that. It had been a year since the CFR banquet, and I hadn't done anything to attract his attention that night. "I'm FBI as well as being in the Order," I said, leaving out a few things.
"You're more than that,"
he said flatly, sitting behind a desk as big as some kid's playgrounds.
"But I have enough on my mind this week without prying into how many sides you're playing. What's the message?"
"It comes from the Order and the CIA both," I said, to be clear and relatively above board. "This it is. The Taiwan heroin shipments will not arrive on time. The Laotian opium fields are temporarily in the hands of the Pathet Lao. Don't believe the Pentagon releases about our troops having the Laotian situation under control. No answer required." I started to rise.
"Wait, damn it,"
Drake said, frowning.
"This is more important than you realize."
His face went blank, and I could tell his mind was racing like an engine with the governor off. It was impressive.
"What's your rank in the Order?"
he asked finally. "Illuminatus Prelator," I confessed humbly.
"Not nearly high enough, but you have more practical espionage experience than a great many higher members. You'll have to do."
The old barracuda relaxed, having come to a decision.
"How much do you know about the cult of the Black Mother?"
he asked. "The most militant and most secret black power group in the country," I said carefully. "They avoid publicity instead of seeking it, because their strategy is based on an eventual coup d'etat, not on revolution. Until a minute ago, I thought no white man in the country even knew of their existence, except those of us in the FBI. The Bureau has never reported on them to other government agencies, because we're ashamed to admit we've never been able to keep an informer inside for long. They all die of natural causes. That's what bugs us."
"Nobody in the Order has ever told you the truth?"
Drake demanded. "No," I said, curious. "I thought what I just told you was the truth."
"Winifred is more close-mouthed than he needs to be,"
Drake said.
"The cult of the Black Mother is entirely controlled by the Order. They monitor ghetto affairs for us. Right now, they predict a revival of the 1960s-style uprisings for late summer in Harlem, on the west side of Chicago and in Detroit. They need to up the addiction rate at least 18%, hopefully 20 or 25% in all those areas, or the property damage will be even more enormous than we are prepared to absorb. They can't do it if they have to cut their present stock even more than it's already cut. There just has to be more junk in the ghettos or all hell will break loose by August."
I began to realize that he had used the word monitor in its strict cybernetic meaning.
"There's only one alternative,"
Drake went on.
"The black market. There's a very cunning and well-organized group that's been trying to crack the CIA syndicate heroin monopoly for quite a while now. The cult of the Black Mother will have to deal with them directly. I don't want the Order involved at all. They would make it messy, and besides, we'll have to crush this group later when we're able to pierce their cover."
The upshot of it was that I found myself on 110th Street in Harlem, feeling very white and unbulletproof, entering a restaurant called the Signifying Monkey. Walking through a lot of hostile stares, I went direct to the coffee-colored woman at the cash register and said, "I've got a tombstone disposition." She gave me a piercing look and muttered,
"Upstairs, after the men's room, the door marked private, knock 5 times."
She grinned maliciously.
"And if you're not kosher, kiss your white ass goodbye, brother."
I went up the stairs, found the door, knocked 5 times, and one eye and an ebony face looked out at me stonily.
"White,"
he said. "Man," I replied.
"Native,"
he came back. "Born," I finished. A bolt slipped on the chain, and the door opened the rest of the way. I never did find out whose idea of a joke that password was. They had lifted it from the Ku Klux Klan, of course. The room I was in was heavy with marijuana smoke, but I could see that it was decently furnished and dominated by an enormous statue of Kali, the Black Mother. I had visions of weird Gunga Din rites and shouts of "Kill for the love of Kali." There were 4 other men in the room, in addition to the one who let me in, and 2 reefers were circulating, 1 Diasil and 1 Wittershins.
"Who you from?"
a voice asked in the murk. "AISB," I answered carefully. "And I'm to speak with Hassan E. Sabah X."
"You're speaking to him,"
said the tallest and blackest character in the bunch, passing me a reefer. I took a quick, deep draw, and Christ, it was good. I'd been half addicted ever since the march on the Pentagon in 1967, where I walked right behind Norman Mailer part of the way, and later fell in with some hippies who were sitting on the steps smoking it. I say I was half addicted since then because, well, 2 of me believe, as a loyal government employee, that the old government publications claiming marijuana is addicting must be true, or the government wouldn't have printed them. Fortunately, the other 2 of me know that it isn't addicting, so I don't go through very bad withdrawal when it's scarce. I started to outline the situation to Hassan E. Sabah X, but the other joint came around, Wittershins, and I took a drag on that. "A man could get stoned doing this," I said facetiously.
"Yeah,"
a satisfied black voice agreed in the gloom. Well, by the time I explained the problem to Hassan, I was so bombed that I immediately let him recruit me for the next step, on his rationalization that a white man could handle it easier than a black man. Actually, I was curious to contact this group of heroin pirates. Hassan wrote the address carefully.
"Now here's the passwords,"
he said.
"You say, 'Do what thou wilt,' shall be the whole of the law. Don't say, 'Do what you will.' They can't stand anybody fucking around with the words. It has something to do with magic." She replies, "Love is the law. Love under will." Then you finish it with, "Every man and every woman is a star." Got it?
You could bet your ass I got it. I was almost goggle-eyed. It was the passwords of the AA.
"One more thing,"
Hassan added.
"Be sure to ask for Miss Mao, not Mama Sutra. Mama isn't cleared for this."
As the Braniff jet took off from Kennedy International, Simon was already deep into Telemachus Sneezed again. He didn't notice the preoccupied-looking, red-headed young man who took the seat across the aisle. If he had, he would have immediately made the identification. Cop. He was reading, "Factory smog is a symbol of progress, of the divine fire of industry, of the flaming deity of Heraclitus."
"Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Hare."
Harry Coyne didn't know what the drug was. Miss Portinari had merely said,
"It takes you further than pot,"
and handed him the tablet. It might be that LSD the hippies use, he reflected, or it might be something else entirely that Hagbard and Fuckup had concocted in the ship's laboratory. Miss Portinari went on chanting,
"Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Hare."
Obediently, he continued to stare into the aquamarine pool between them. She wore a yellow robe and sat placidly in the lotus position.
"I've got to know,"
he had told her.
I can't go around with 2 sets of memories and never be sure which are real and which Hagbard just put in my head, like a man puts a baby in a woman? Did I kill all those people, or didn't I?
You must be in the proper frame of mind before you can accept the answer.
She had replied remotely.
Harry Coinsha, Harry Coinsha, Harry, Harry.
Was she changing the chant or was it the drug? He tried to keep calm and continue staring into the pool as she had ordered, but the porcelain design around it was changing. Instead of two dolphins chasing each other's tails, like the astrological sign of Pisces, the age that was ending, according to Hagbard, it was now one long serpent-like creature trying to swallow its own tail.
That's me,
he thought.
A lot of people have told me I'm as thin and long as a snake. And it's everybody else, too.
He realized suddenly.
I'm seeing what George told me. The self pursuing the self and trying to govern it. The self trying to swallow the self.
But as he stared, fascinated, the pool turned red, blood red, the color of guilt, and he felt it reach out and try to pull him down into it, into red oblivion, a void made flush.
It's alive!
He screamed.
Jesus motherfucking Christ!
Miss Portinari casually stirred the pool, remote and calm, and its spiral inward slowly turned back to aquamarine. Harry felt himself blushing. It was only an hallucination, and muttered,
Pardon my language, ma'am.
Don't apologize,
she said sharply.
The most important truths always appear first as blasphemies or obscenities. That's why every great innovator is persecuted. And the sacraments look obscene, too, to an outsider. The Eucharist is just sublimated cannibalism to the unawakened. When the Pope kisses the feet of the laity, he looks like an old toe queen to some people. The rites of Pan look like a suburban orgy. Think about what you said. Since it has five words and fits the law of fives, it is especially significant.
This is a weird bunch. But they know important things,
Harry reminded himself. He looked deep into the blue spiral and silently repeated to himself,
It's alive, Jesus motherfucking Christ, it's alive.
Jesus, looking strangely hawk-faced and Hagbardian, rose from the pool.
This is my Bodhi,
he said, pointing. Harry looked and saw Buddha sitting beneath the Bodhi tree. Tattvam Asi, he said, and the falling leaves of the tree turned into millions of TV sets, all broadcasting the same Laurel and Hardy movie. Now look what you made me do, Hardy was saying. In a previous incarnation, Harry saw himself as a centurion, Semper Cuni Linctus, driving the nails into the cross.
Look,
he said to Jesus,
nothing personal. I'm only following orders.
So am I,
Jesus said.
My father's orders. Aren't we all?
Look into the pool,
Miss Portinari repeated.
Just look into the pool.
It was like each Chinese box had another Chinese box inside it. But the best of all belonged to Miss Mao Su Shu. We were reclining in her trim but elegant pad on West 87th Street, passing a joint back and forth and comparing multiple identities. We were naked on a bearskin rug, a dream come true, for she was my ideal woman.
I got into the AA first, Tobias,
she was saying.
They recruited me at a Baha'i meeting. They have cruisers out looking for likely prospects in every mystical group, from Subu to Scientology, you know. Then Naval Intelligence contacted me, and I reported to them on what the AA was up to. I'm not flexible as you, though, and my loyalties tend to stay fairly constant. Chiefly, I was reporting to AA what I gleaned from Naval Intelligence. I did believe in the AA, basically, until I met him.
That reminds me, I said, jealous of the worshipful way she said him, as if talking about a god. If he's coming soon, shouldn't we get up and put some clothes on?
If you want to be bourgeois,
she said. While we were dressing, I remembered something. By the way, I asked casually, who are you spying on Mama Sutra for? The AA, Naval Intelligence, or him?
All three of them.
She was starting to pull her panties on, and I said suddenly, wait. I knelt and kissed her pussy one last time. "For the nicest Chinese box I've opened in this whole case," I said gallantly. That was my Illuminati training. As an FBI man, I was ashamed of such a perverted act. We finished dressing, and she was pouring some wine, a light German vintage from, of all places, Bavaria, when the knock came. Miss Mao sidled over to the door in her slinky Chinese dress and said softly,
"Hail, Eris."
"All hail, Discordia,"
came a voice from outside. She slipped the lock, and a little fat man walked in. My first reaction was astonishment. He didn't look anything like the super-intellectual superhero she had described.
"Hagbard couldn't come," he said briefly. "I'll handle the sale and initiate you,"
with a glance at me,
"into the Legion of Dynamic Discord, if you're really ready, as Miss Mao says, to battle every government on Earth and the Illuminati to boot."
"I'm ready," I said passionately. "I'm tired of being a puppet on four sets of strings. Actually, I know I just wanted a fifth set."
"Good,"
he said.
"Put her there."
And he held out his hand. As we shook, he said,
"Episcopo's Jim Cartwright of the Mad Dog Cabal."
"Tobias Knight," I said, "of the FBI, the CIA, the AA, and the Illuminati." He blinked briefly.
"I've met double agents and triple agents, but you're the first quadruple agent in my experience. I guess this was inevitable by the law of fives. Welcome to the fifth ring of the world's oldest continuous five-ring circus. Prepare for death and rebirth."
"Jesus motherfucking Christ! It's alive!"
Greetings. Fuck up here. I hope you enjoyed this unabridged Deep Leaf audio production of Illuminatus Part 2, The Golden Apple, by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson. This program was produced and directed by Lance Bauscher, featuring the voice talents of Mark Atherley, Glenn Carlson, Digby Christian, Scott Crisp, Melissa Hutchison, Marilyn Fowler, Wendy Tremont King, John Mercer, Jay Momay, Eddie Nix, John Parsons, Douglas Smith, John True, Perry Whittle, and Randall Wong. Recorded at What You Say Studios, San Francisco. Production copyright 2007, Deep Leaf Productions. If you listen to this program via a borrowed or pirated copy, please consider paying for it at deepleafaudio.com, or at least convince or otherwise hypnotize a friend or foe to purchase a copy. All hail Crab Newberg. Praise Bobs.